You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We're just under 24 hours away, Jess, from the next Fed decision, FOMC. We got some economic news today. We talked about it, right? Consumer confidence down to a five-month low, dropping to a five-month low in October. And then you got employment costs unexpectedly accelerating in the third quarter. So that reminds us we've got a strong, strong labor market.
And especially with some thoughts ahead of this FOMC meeting, back with us is Dr. Steve Shanky, chief economist and advisor at Keel Point and former staff member of the U.S. Treasury while White House National Security Council. And then, of course, Steve is on Zoom in Mexico. Also with us is Bloomberg Economics' own U.S. economist, Stuart Paul, here, of course, in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. And so, Stuart, I wanted to kick off with today's data. So we did get a lot of indications here what wage growth does look like in the economic snapshot, obviously, of the economy when you are thinking about Fed Chair Jerome Powell tomorrow. What are your thoughts and what is, do you think that the Federal Reserve should do? Because we're not going to get those quarterly economic projections or the dot plots tomorrow.
So it was a bit of a shocker to see the employment cost index tick up in Q3. It departs from what we've been seeing with the Atlanta Fed wage tracker, departs from what we've been seeing in the non-farm payrolls report, where we've had modest wage growth. That's actually been relatively consistent with 2% inflation, with the Fed's 2% inflation target. We don't think that the Fed is going to be in a position to hike tomorrow. 97-some-odd% odds, market-implied probability that the Fed's going to maintain its current policy rate when it makes its announcement tomorrow. And we think that that is the right move, though I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to tell Chairman Powell how to do his job.
I wouldn't either. Having said that, wait, I want to bring Steve in too, because what I think about, a very wise individual said to me that Jay Powell, he's a lawyer, and he looks at the data in front of him, Steve, and that's what's going to determine the decision he's going to make on any given FOMC day. Having said that, so what is the data playbook that Jay Powell and company will be dealing with when they make that decision or just ahead of that decision tomorrow?
Well, I absolutely agree, Carol. And the data that he has in front of him is a little bit overwhelming, just because it's so broad. I mean, we had this 4.9 GDP growth number, but consumer spending was up 4%, and a rebuilding of inventories, which is a big variable, was up. So, how do they discount that? Maybe he'll say something about that in his comments. As Stuart said, the employment cost index unexpectedly up, but at the same time, year over year, private wages and salaries were down a bit. Unemployment is not likely to fall. Mm-hmm. Wages are looking to be on a downward trend when we look forward, and I think that the Fed can probably see that. So the discussion, even with no rate increase, no change in tone, I think would be very interesting as Chairman Powell answers questions about these data that are a little bit inconvenient, but at the same time, he has a lot of other things that he can fall back to and right. point to.
Well, come back in, Stu, because I do wonder in terms of, you know, what you think will be top of mind or the message that he's going to need to get across in that press conference, or what he might be questioned about the most? Because I feel like we've all known, okay, no decision. So we moved to the press conference.
Right. So moving to the press conference, here's just a typical strategy that Powell deploys at the press conference. If they were to ever make a hawkish move, he ends up sounding a little bit more dovish during the press conference. If they do something that's a little bit, incrementally dovish.
I know that Fed playbook.
Right, exactly. And you just hold on to your seat as you watch equities move when he's in the middle of the press conference. But when they make something that's a little bit more dovish, when they hold rates steady, as they will tomorrow, he's going to most likely sound hawkish. He's going to talk about the persistence of growth. Even if you take Steve's really important points into consideration about 30%, about 30% of that 4.9% Q over Q growth that we saw in Q3 came from inventories. That doesn't exactly scream like organic growth in the U.S. economy. Even if you were to take that into consideration, he's going to end up saying every meeting is a live meeting. They're only making decisions for today. They're not making decisions for tomorrow. Based on the latest SEP, they're still showing another rate hike this year. Mm. So he's going to end up sounding a bit more hawkish at the press conference.
Interesting.
How much does that jawboning stew feed into the mistake from transitory that he dropped almost 2 years ago?
I think that it is still something that they think about. They don't want to end up with egg on their face in perpetuity. They do want to end up showing some sort of dedication to bringing inflation back toward the 2% target after having made such an important misstep and being so all too confident that inflation would come down naturally, and instead they're actually having to put in a lot of the work. And given the fact that the U.S. hasn't been especially interest sensitive in their spending to date, and it's taken a lot more hiking than anticipated,
right,
I think that any sort of hawkish tone may exactly be part of that jest and may be part of that legacy of dealing with that transitory egg on their face, so
hey,
to speak.
Hey, Steve, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, we've got a great story in the Bloomberg about corporate credit strength, and that to really, tame inflation, the Fed, they're looking to tighten those financial conditions across the economy, but they really haven't made much of a dent in corporate America yet. So we're talking about, we look specifically at the extra yield investors' demand for risk in the U.S. investment grade and high yield bond markets, which has remained below their 20-year averages and well under levels seen during historical times of stress in the economy. And borrowing remains robust. So would the Fed like to see that tighten up a little bit and not be so upbeat that there's more work to be done? They look at things like that.
Well, they certainly would like to see the market providing less liquidity. And that goes right to the point that you make. But they're also very wary, I believe, notwithstanding wanting to continue their hawkish tone, of doing anything that is going to fuel a further sell-off in the bond market. They seem to be happy with where mid and longer-term rates are. And so while they might not be particularly happy with all the liquidity that continues to exist in the corporate market, my belief is that they'll be patient about it.
Can I ask you, do you feel like the Fed's getting close to a neutral rate?
Yes, I think that they are. Just the comments that some of the governors, FOMC members, and Jay Powell made this last week, they seem to be getting comfortable with that. To Stuart's point, they don't want to let up on their hawkish tone, but when you sort of parse out some of the things that they've been saying recently, I think the answer to that is yes.
Stu, we also have another wild card for tomorrow with the refunding in the Treasury market. What are your expectations, and what do you think that could mean for yields as far as what that pressure could mean for maybe longer duration growth stocks in the equity market?
With growing auctions, with higher deficits than had been previously projected, there's reason to believe that even just the term premium that had been getting blown out, that had been raising the entire yield curve, that has been front of mind for Fed policymakers, could even just get blown out even further. One thing that's super important, though, is that when you see higher long-term rates moving as a consequence of a larger term premium, mm-hmm. it means the Fed has less work that it has to do. It could sort of sit back and relax, not really relax, but at least wait to see the economic consequences of higher long-term yield continuing to ripple through. So, for example, while the Fed had been doing most of the heavy lifting, deeply inverting the curve, raising front end rates as aggressively as we've seen at any point in the past 40 years. Now with longer term rates catching up as a consequence of a larger term premium, the Fed can sort of slow down. And I think that that is downstream from fiscal policy, and that is going to be an important factor tomorrow.
Yeah, you do feel like, hey, the Fed gets a little bit of an assist, it wouldn't mind. Steve, saving the last 45 seconds, minute for you here, in terms of that, the specifics on that refunding, you've worked at Treasury, how does that factor into, and you've worked at the government, you've worked at the White House, how does that factor in, you think, into the Fed's thinking?
Well, they have to be aware of it. You know, they've gotten caught up on this a couple of times in the past on their repo activities. Mm-hmm. So they're certainly mindful of it. They want to be respectful, and the Treasury Secretary has indicated a point of view that maybe isn't fully embraced by the market. But I think that the Fed is going to be sensitive and accommodating.
Going to be interesting. Very interesting. Hey, guys, thank you so much. I feel like there's a lot going on, but we need a little bit of a setup ahead of that Fed decision, which, you know, 24 hours from now, less than 24, it will be front and center for all of us. Guys, thank you so much. Bloomberg Economics U.S. Economist Stuart Paul joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, along with Dr. Steve Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor over at Kill Point, as we mentioned, former staff member at the U.S. Treasury and the White House National Security Council, joining us on Zoom in Mexico.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
AMD, which is down, continues to be down about 4% in the aftermarket following its earnings. By the way, their chips have been used in the automotive world as well as Tesla's. So we want to talk about AMD, we want to talk about Tesla, and we also want to talk about another EV maker, car maker, Stellantis. I'm trying to roll it all together. And I'm going to toss it over to our Ed Ludlow, who is co-host of Bloomberg Technology on Bloomberg TV, because I'm going to throw it all at you. But let's start with AMD. I know there's a lot on your plate. This is our weekly look at the world of EVs. We call it Bloomberg Plugged In, but let's start with AMD, which is down in the aftermarket. What jumps out for you, Ed?
Yeah, it's just a mixture of disappointment, right? If you go to their forecast for the fourth quarter, the revenue range is $5.8 to $6.4 billion. The street wanted to see $6.4 billion. So the mid-range point is kind of disappointing. But the biggest story here is that they're not seeing the PC recovery that Intel saw. They make GPUs that go into gaming consoles and high-end gaming PCs and are warning us that's slowing down. And even though they told us that their super special AI accelerator chips, MI300, are on track to go into production and ship in the final 3 months of this year, there's kind of no tangible boost from that, right? It's not going to book as substantive revenue until the beginning of next year. And it will take them time to catch up with NVIDIA and the H100. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, which is never really what you want in earnings, but the market's a little disappointed.
And shares of AMD were actually up more than 50% heading into this report. How much of this also, when you have another stock that may have gotten ahead of itself after last year's sell-off in chip names, does this make sense for some investors?
Well, this is part of the story. You know, the data center business was a disappointment last quarter, a missed estimate. So they have a data center business that isn't yet reflecting the opportunity of AI. They're the number two PC processor maker behind Intel. And Intel gave us really promising glimpse that maybe that market is recovering. And when all told is at the end of 2023, shipments will look better when we get them. AMD's results don't really reflect that. And as I said, we're excited about the MI300 AI accelerator, but it's some way off still showing up in the financial results.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. If you were sitting down with the CEO, what would you ask him? Or ask, yeah.
Or her, Lisa
her,
Su.
That's what I meant.
I'd ask, what evidence do you have that you can continue at such a click that the MI300 will gain traction in the market that the H100 did? You know, all of the CEOs of these chip companies say that we're just at the very beginning of this AI thing. There's going to be demand for all kinds of chips, all kinds of GPUs. Well, if that's the case, give me some data, what the next 12 months looks like and how many of these you think you'll sell, and most importantly, to who?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, to go down the revenue line. If you look at our DES page, right? Like, I mean, gaming is important. Client, areas important. Data centers are important. I mean, you're talking about, you know, over $6 billion revenue for each of those. So these are areas that they really want to be kind of, you know, firing on all cylinders, if you will, correct? And you kind of get this mixed bag.
And it's in the history of both AMD and NVIDIA. The GPU, graphics processing unit, has its origins in video games.
Right.
It's a chip that can help handle lots of parallel data processes. That makes it great for AI. So NVIDIA translated that to the AI use case. AMD is seeing it can. We just haven't got any proof that it's done it yet.
I wanted to switch gears and ask you, of course, about Tesla, because the valuation and just seeing how much it shaved in billions because of some of these demand issues, how does this sort of play into that when we are talking about chip makers and then obviously what this means for the EV space?
Do you guys ever just wake up and think about monetary policy and rates?
Yes.
I do.
I do too. And
Elon Musk is talking a lot about interest rates. And why does the Fed use rates as a mechanism to control inflation? Higher rates tamper demand in the economy. That's literally the mechanics of what they're trying to do. And we're seeing that play out now in the car industry. In the EV context, the early adopters have been and gone. They've bought their EVs. Now it's the rest of Americans who face all kinds of household spending pressures. And there is evidence that EVs are kind of a victim of that. You know, earlier in the year, Tesla used price cuts to unlock new pockets of demand. And the narrative since October 18th is Tesla's shares are down almost 20%. They've shed billions of market cap because we're starting to question the demand that's actually there and the severity of the impact of rates.
I mean, is it though? All across the EV space, I mean, we've had a lot of conversations, Ed, right, around this. And we thought, you know, we're getting to this tipping point in terms of EV adoption, certainly throughout the world, but maybe getting closer to it here in the US. What's happened?
Well, the other evidence that we point to is that the legacy automakers, for example, General Motors, that are managing a transition from combustion engine to EV, have also tempered back their EV expectations. A part of that, of course, is the impact of the UAW strikes and sort of business continuity and operations. But a part of it is a rethink on demand and, you know, rethinking how much or how many EVs they're going to have to build and how quickly to meet what is a lessening demand picture.
But you have then Stellantis out, right? And their shares rallied better than expected revenue in the third quarter. And they talked about robust demand for their electric Jeep Avenger. So,
and this is the beautiful story for a global news network like us. Because Stellantis has this whole thing on a place called Europe.
Yeah.
And in Europe, it's a completely different market where smaller form factor vehicles at lower price points are doing really well. Brands that you have not heard of, like Citroën, have done well in that market. And there are models of Jeep that Stellantis make in Europe that we don't even have here in the US yet. And, you know, so Stellantis is an interesting one because it was late to the EV party, but its strategy is working in that continent, and that insulated them somewhat from the North America story, where actually their pricing power on combustion engines was better anyway, and that helped offset some of the UAW disruption.
What hurts them when it comes to some of their U.S. counterparts and rivals?
What did you say? Sorry, I lost you in my ear. U.S. counterparts and rivals.
For Stellantis, as far as when it does have the ability to be more unscathed, obviously, in Europe. But when it comes to the U.S., sort of the dynamic where it has had other issues trying to catch up with maybe some of its rivals.
Yeah, it's a really good question because Stellantis, under its different brands in this country, principally Jeep, Chrysler, Ram, does not have a sort of high volume selling EV model. you know, there are two parts to it. You know, if you take the pickup market, there's extreme brand loyalty here. So it's fair to assume that when we get an electric Ram, that will resonate with a sort of loyal Ram audience. But in the consumer EV domain, it's getting very competitive. You know, you not just have Tesla, but other pure play names like Rivian, and Ford and GM moved quicker to bring battery electric pickups and SUVs to a country that loves those bigger form factor cars. Stellantis is late, but they're coming end of this year, beginning of 2024. How much traction they gain will be really interesting to track.
You know, it makes me wonder, you know, coming off of all of these deals with the UAW, the big three here in the U.S., obviously Stellantis included, of course, in that, whether or not they're going to be able to stick to their EV missions. I just wonder about the cost side of things, Ed.
So what Stellantis said is that the UAW strikes cost them about $3 billion of sales revenue. Mm-hmm. But on the bottom line, the impact was much more muted, about $800 million of impact. Because they were able to control their own cost discipline. And that's kind of been a feature of the Stellantis story. But it also delays. You know, they canceled their CES showcase, for example. And part of selling EVs to consumers is getting out there, talking them up. So it has had a sort of long-term strategic impact.
All right, I just want to know, when you wake up, do you really think about the Fed monetary policy, or is it about what Elon had to say? Come on.
I really mean it, because partly, like, if you want to buy a house or a car,
yeah,
those are the two most important decisions you make.
Look at all the
and
surveys.
Rates matter.
Right, all the surveys we've been doing here at Bloomberg. It's top of mind for everyone. Everybody's feeling the pinch in it. Ed Ludlow, thank you so much. An incredible roundup of a lot of different stories, but tying it all together and finding that common thread. Ed, of course, is co-host of Bloomberg Technology on Bloomberg TV.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
On the Bloomberg Today, there's a story about how Google executives downplayed the company's artificial intelligence position during some testimony at a landmark federal antitrust trial, saying the company has tried to be slow and cautious because of the dangerous power of the technology. We, Jess, are definitely living in uncharted waters when it comes to generative AI and where it takes our world for better or worse. We're excited about chip companies,
yes,
and what they might make and what they might do. We just talked about AMD. But in terms of society, I think we're all trying to figure it out ultimately about what the impact will be.
And what the potential ramifications could be for users of this.
Well, we have a great guest. Martina Larkin is the CEO of Project Liberty. It's an international nonprofit. They talk about working to create a new civic architecture for the digital world. So let's get to it. She is a former member of the World Economic Forum's Executive Committee and sits on several nonprofit boards, including one devoted to innovation and technology at the European Commission. She joins us on Zoom in London. Martina, welcome to Bloomberg Business Week and our Bloomberg community. For those who are listening and watching right now, tell us a little bit more about your group and the mission that you are on.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you for having me. Yes, as you said, we're building a safer, healthier internet, and you know, really believe that this should be designed and governed for the common good, for society, and not just for profit. I think, you know, in that recent lawsuit that we've seen, these tech companies really having more of a motive around profit rather than the benefit of society. So we believe it's very important to refocus basically on the individuals and on society and look at what we can do better when it comes to social media, but now also AI, obviously. And we've seen all the problems that it has created, whether it's the mental health crises or political polarization, the decline in trust in media and in our institutions. So we want to take steps and build solutions that solve for that and, you know, create a better internet, which is possible.
And to be fair, there's a bunch of lawsuits going on. I think the lawsuit you mentioned is the one by California, the state of California, and more than 30 state attorney generals against Meta, yeah, platforms, right, for allegedly enticing children onto Instagram and Facebook with addictive features. So that's going on. I'm assuming that's the case you were talking about.
Correct, yes.
How exactly are you building this?
So there's a number of factors here that we're considering. One is the technology itself, right? We want to build safer, healthier technology, more responsible technology. And we have developed a decentralized protocol that allows us to retain control of our data and change the nature of both the internet and social media by changing the business model, which lies at the bottom of all of that. And you know, the fact that those big companies own our data and use it against us, and particularly those who are vulnerable, children and others, lies very much at the heart of that. But it goes beyond that. So the technology is obviously one aspect, but we also need regulation to solve for this, contributing to some of the safeguards and you know, guardrails around this. And of course, the research and the governance is equally important. And then we strongly believe that we need to get people and organizations involved. So we have built a global alliance for responsible tech with organizations from around the world who want to contribute to this mission as well.
There's a lot out there, as you well know, you know, the ad model, right? The acquisition of a lot of personal information, the dossiers that have been built on each and every one of us. That's pretty powerful, and it's very profitable for these companies. There's also regulating information and misinformation, but then we get into, you know, are we kind of limiting kind of the right to speech? So if you had to pick one target that you would love to change, what would it be, and how do we do it?
Well, I think we have a real obligation to protect children first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to put forward stronger legal protections for children online. I think that's just the basics. And then I was in, you know, Americans, you know, agree with that. The polls show that 70% of Americans and about 91% of parents want that as well. And they want stronger protections of their children online. But we also need to require more transparency, and we need to transform the industry with a new set of expectations around what is happening with the data, what kind of, you know, models lie behind this, what are the business models behind it, what is happening to the data. And this has become even more apparent with AI, that these organizations don't even know where the data is coming from and what is happening to it. So that those two factors, I think, are really important. But also, of course, building this new tech ecosystem, building these new technologies that actually, you know, give us new hope and sort of a way forward, where we just don't even have to look at the regulation, but we can just use the new technologies that enable that kind of environment to become a reality.
What's the timetable on those types of new technologies when you do have things like AI constantly changing?
Yeah, so on social media, we have this decentralized protocol right now live. So we have MeWe, which is a social media platform in the US that is using that decentralized protocol right now. So it's here and now. We just need to accelerate it and get more people on it and more people demanding it. And that's the first step. And then, you know, this will help transform where we're going.
Martina, what do you think is the biggest obstacle? I feel like we are looking over towards the European area in terms of a bigger fight when it comes to privacy issues. And I feel like those in the U.S. are kind of watching what's going on overseas. What is the obstacle to getting it done? Is it lobbying? Certainly in the U.S., is it lobbying and money? Or what is it that you think prevents, like, age verification when it comes to something that would probably make it a lot safer for kids, or at least we could kind of police it a little bit more? Just got about 40 seconds left.
So one point certainly is to that people don't know that there's options, right? From a tech perspective, they don't even know that can have different, doesn't have to be like that, right? The tech can be designed differently. And the second one is just individuals and organizations need to demand greater transparency and, you know, push forward regulation like COSA, for example, in the US. That can be something that just is a first step towards building this much healthier ecosystem that we're talking about.
And I'm sorry, what was that, COSA? Children's
COSA,
Online.
Yes.
What does that stand for?
Yes, the children's, like, privacy bill, basically, which was introduced this year in the US.
All right. So appreciate it. I feel like this is a longer conversation, and hopefully we can catch up with you again. And curious too, as you see maybe some progress, to check back in with us. Martina Larkin, she's Chief Executive Officer of Project Liberty, joining us on Zoom from London. If you missed any of it, be sure to check out our podcast feed a little bit later on.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
Happy Halloween, everyone. Tis the season for spooky movies. And did you know that of the top 20 most profitable films based on return of investments, ROI, since 1977, nine are actually horror movies, according to movie data analytics firms The Numbers. Looking into this lucrative business of horror movies and how Hollywood just seems to just get it so right is Bloomberg News media and entertainment reporter Samantha Stewart. Sam joining us along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, both here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Sam's story already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and, of course, on the Bloomberg. Oh, my God. ROI. Big time.
Pretty good, right? I feel like we did this story just so I could ask this question, which is,
set up.
Do you like scary movies? Like, oh, man.
So who doesn't like to get the heart moving?
Scream dates me, but okay. I have a soft spot for, I have a soft spot for these scary movies. I think many of us like to be scared.
Do you really love them?
Yeah, but, you know, I get scared. Okay. So I was an 8-year-old. He can hear, like, the key change, and he's just like, I'm out of here. He's definitely not watching any of the movies that we're writing about here. What fascinated me about this, and why we tapped Samantha for it, this is a money-making formula, and Hollywood has found it and almost perfected it. And it's like, the thing I like about it is, like, how little money can you spend to have a nice ROI. And some of these movies become franchises, and they just have become this ongoing little geyser of money. And it's like, if you want the shortcut to, like, how to make it in Hollywood, I think you're looking at it. It's about scary movies. Samantha, help us out here. When you started this, what did you learn along the way?
I mean, it was really interesting just to see how profitable these scary movies are. I mean, looking at Paranormal Activity, especially, its initial budget was only $15,000. And then
$15,000?
That's crazy.
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yeah, only $15,000, and then went on to gross over $194 million worldwide. So that's a really big bang for your buck, I would say.
A really big bang. That's, like, off the
like
charts.
Like I said, how little money can you spend in order to, like, and that's just the first movie. How many did they make? It was like, you know, there's more than two sequels.
Sequels, right. Yeah. So why are they so cheap and fast to make?
I mean, a lot of the time they don't have to spend as much money on A-class type of artists, I mean, and actors, because they're a lot cheaper to kind of pay for these lower budget actors. And then you can also really spend less on sets and, like, CGI and all that kind of stuff. You don't require the same kind of things that maybe a Marvel film needs to be made. You can do a lot of this on a lower budget. I mean, even Paranormal Activity, the first-time filmmaker Oren Peli made it in his house, actually.
That's what's crazy, right? We've all gotten so spoiled. Like, did you go back and watch, like, the first Star Wars, and you're like, no special effects there? Like, we've all gotten so used to, like, we want to be entertained with all these special effects. That's not what they do. Mm-hmm. They just scare the heck out of us.
Yeah.
Well, isn't it true, though, that, you know, special effects can be gory, they can do things that, you know, fills in your imagination. For $15,000, your imagination will terrify you. And I think that is also part of the formula here, too, is, like, don't spend the money on doing all the CGI stuff. Just let your brain fill in the gaps, and your brain's going to do the work. So who in Hollywood does this better than anybody?
I think Blumhouse has really kind of perfected that recipe. I mean, they've went on to gross already $5.7 billion for all the films that they've produced. And I mean, look at Five Nights at Freddy's, which had just an absolutely stellar debut with $80 million. I actually have not yet, okay. Which is crazy.
I will say the art and the story for it makes me a little terrified.
No, the animatronics are definitely scary, especially.
Well, that was the thing is, like, animatronics have always terrified me, but nobody made a movie out of it. Yeah, now I definitely am scared.
And they're the production company for Paranormal Activity?
Yes, Paranormal Activity was kind of their breakout film, which really helped them kind of perfect and refine that low-budget model that generates this huge ROI.
Well, talk to us about Jason Blum.
Oh, well, Jason Blum, I mean,
I'm kind of obsessed with. He just did like a Shark Tank. They did the Halloween version and he came on and, you know, pointed out like how well he has done and how in terms of top grossing movies, like he just has a ton, like one after another.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I really think it's kind of honing into that whole lower budget idea. And again, kind of doing away with a lot of the things that these bigger budget films at Hollywood are known for, often find to be kind of integral. And it's taking these kind of more original ideas and just going off of those and being able to make these movies that have these huge, huge payoffs.
Okay, so we've talked about the really cheap ones. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the most noteworthy director, Jason Blum. We haven't talked about The Conjuring.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. That's the biggest franchise, actually, which was made by Atomic Monster, which was founded by James Wan. So he created the whole Conjuring franchise. And I mean, by now, there's about 8 films, and it's grossed over $2 billion at the box office, which is insane.
So what was amazing about that one, again, it started with like a modest beginning,
right?
And then you start ratcheting up the money, and but like they did that first one in like 38 days, so like,
yeah, that's what's remarkable.
I mean, like, and that
on
takes
a single
me back
college
to,
campus,
yeah, and like Blair Witch, same thing, like, yeah. that was the one for me, like where I was like, it just showed how you can nail this genre and do it so well and just scare the bejesus out of people,
right? And everybody was talking about it,
yeah.
I mean, and that was like, if Jace me again. Slightly pre-internet.
Everybody,
you know?
Yeah. Joe Weber's a little obsessed with this genre.
Real? Could you tell? Okay, so which ones surprised you that didn't kind of like rise above?
That didn't rise above?
Yeah, like that didn't break through. Like when you, I mean, part of the metrics that we're looking at here are ones that were like, you know, box office success. Midsommar didn't, probably not a huge moneymaker, but like also a great example of this genre. So like, if you don't have the money, if you don't, like, there's still this cult thing that can happen, right? And like, The Witch was another one that was really good in this regard, where it had like really high, kind of like film allure, I guess, right?
Oh,
so like, what are the dynamics that, you know, not that don't always just need money to succeed, right?
I mean, I think that what's really interesting about these films is that they're able to generate this huge ROI, even though they don't always get the best reviews from critics. I mean, a lot of these films aren't that well received.
Well said.
a lot of these films aren't that well received. And I mean, one researcher found that actually the horror genre has the lowest correlation between box office performance and its critical reception, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, you look at the ratings for some of like the highest grossing films this year, and they're not that impressive.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I also thought it was interesting, and I kind of felt this, okay, I'm going in a completely, you know, different direction. Don't judge me. But Barbie, like, I felt like for the first time, like, I was back in a theater, and it was kind of a group experience. We were all kind of laughing and, like, kind of, you know, or whatever, together. But this genre in particular, right, it is about a group experience.
Yeah, I think that social kind of environment that horror really invites is what really brings people to the theaters to keep seeing these movies. I mean, especially looking at, like, Gen Z and seeing how much more they prefer the horror genre compared to, like, the adult population at large. I mean, at least a third of Gen Z lists horror as one of their favorite genres compared to just 22% of U.S. adults. And I mean, even 66% of Gen Z has seen a horror movie in theaters in the last 12 months.
In theaters?
Yes, yeah. In theaters, which actually I think says a lot. Actually gone in theaters. And it was compared to much lower margins across the board.
I think that's that idea of like, we don't care what critics have to say, but we want to go do this together. It's like, it's that experiential thing that so, you know, experiential economy for $12 and, you know, everybody makes money on it. It's, pretty interesting.
What makes me wonder, like reading this, and I'm going to go back to the return on investment, because I feel like whenever we like look at something, you know, that is such a part of the Bloomberg conversation, like it's just off the charts. So why aren't other major, bigger studios, or are they chasing some of this?
I mean, when you look at like a lot of the films that perform very well, I mean, you think of the superhero films, the Marvel films, Avatar, they're spending all this money on films, on what's it called, like CGI and IP and all those kinds of things. So I think that's what really kind of puts them apart, is that these horror films, again, like I said, don't have to invest in those same kinds of expensive assets of a film.
I just think, right, if I was a studio, I'd be like, why wouldn't I chase some of this? I mean, it's really kind of remarkable. And it just, what?
We got to go personal. I got to know, what's the movie that you won't watch because you're too scared of it?
Okay, you're going to really laugh at me, but this is a really, really old. It was called Trilogy of Terror with Karen Black. I was a little kid. My older siblings were watching it, but there was this,
hold
like,
on, I'm getting the Google to look this one up.
It was this, like, doll, and it, like, lost its chain, and then all of a sudden, it was like, it wasn't a voodoo doll, but it was like, I can't remember, but it was like a little doll, and it started, like, attacking her with a knife.
No.
And it was like, she's sitting on the couch, and it, like, starts attacking her ankle. And then, like, it's thrown in the oven, and she, like, inhales the fumes, and then she becomes, like, the crazy woman. It's terrifying.
Sounds
I wouldn't put
scary.
My feet down, like, on my couch forever.
Samantha, what's the Halloween movie that you don't want to watch because you're too scared of it?
Oh, I was traumatized by The Mist when I was a lot younger. My brothers made me watch it when I was, like, 8 years old, and it was just the most terrifying thing ever. Yeah. Didn't want to go to a grocery store just for the fear of getting locked inside one. So I think that's it for me. Never again.
I never liked When a Stranger Calls. It's terrifying me. There's one that was made in the 70s, and then they redid it.
Is that the one where it says, like, they're in the house? They're in the house?
He's actually calling her from inside the house. It's absolutely terrifying. And I've seen it once, and I never want to watch it again.
But it is interesting, like, that concept of, like, you don't have to spell everything out. Like, I think about, go back to Jaws, right? And Steven Spielberg. Like, the shark wasn't working, and so all they had was the fin. But it was so effective in that you kind of just imagined so much of what was going on. The subtlety of it was really kind of cool. And then there's Alien, like the monsters, man. That scared the heck
out of me. I mean, those are scary. All of these are. I mean, and that's the thing is, like, I think there's this... they stick with you, right?
Absolutely.
And, like, that's the thing about all of these. It's like, I don't really want to watch these again. I don't really want to see the sequel. And yet, I know other people. I can appreciate how good of a business this is because it just keeps churning out new ones.
What I was really also fascinated about your story is that, okay, it's all these kind of, I feel like, upstarts, people doing it differently, maybe weren't household names, but now you're getting to know them. But it was a Stephen King movie, right? That was released in 2017 by Warner Brothers, grossed $700 million worldwide, making it the biggest horror money maker ever. So, like, you go back to the master. I don't know about the ROI, though. I bet there wasn't.
Well, just think about
right?
Just how good he has been in this genre. Again, I mean, like, look, like, that's, you know, Shakespeare. I mean,
it is
that level of good.
Yes, yes.
Where it just again and again and again and again and again. And, like, those were old ones that I think some of them have been remade. Like, that's one I just don't want to see, by the way.
Sam, I'm curious, when you were given this mission, did y'all, was this another, like, creeping by your desk and, like, hey? But I wonder when you, like, started this,
do you like scary?
Like, how much was, you know, kind of surprising to you as you kind of dug deeper and deeper into this? Because the numbers are really impressive from, you know, folks here who all are really kind of gung-ho on everything financials. But what really kind of jumped out for you?
I mean, so much about it was really shocking to me because I personally was always a horror fan. But I never really had thought about, like, the budgets for those kinds of films and how it's not always those A-list actors that you're seeing. And I didn't really think about how much cheaper that would make a film. I just thought about how much fun it was to watch with my family or with my friends and to be scared. And I think seeing that kind of verified in all of the research that I've done, it was really interesting, really rewarding.
So you're like, Joel, I'm going to the movies, I got research to do.
Genuine research, right? I look, like, every one of these ones that I've seen, I haven't seen them all, probably won't see them all.
I love that.
But there's this thing that I think just grabs you about this genre. Yep. And when you realize that there is this business story to it that is this dramatic, this ROI side, you just know we're going to be talking about this again for, you know, decades. Well, as long as we're making movies.
We talk about alt investments, right? I think if I'm an investor, I'm like, yeah, I'll give you some money. Here's $25,000. Go make five movies, you know? Really fun. Great story. And like I said, we were talking about it throughout the day. So it really resonated with all of us. Sam Stewart, she's Bloomberg News Media and Entertainment Reporter. Check out her story on the Bloomberg and online. And of course, the editor of Jill Weber, who knew? Lover of horror movies. Happy Halloween, everyone.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session on this Tuesday, October 31st. As you just heard from Charlie, equities just kind of rolling over, but little change, a little bit higher on this basically FOMC Eve. I'm Carol Masser along with Jess Metten in for Tim Stenovic on this Tuesday. It's an interesting market, but it does feel like we're just kind of waiting.
It definitely seems to be the case, especially at the end of October, which technically is the most volatile month of the year, but the worst one is actually September followed by August. So hopefully maybe we're getting into a better seasonal period.
Santa Claus rally, don't even go there. All right, let's see what Jimmy Lee has to say. He's founder and CEO at the Registered Investment Advisor Wealth Consulting Group. He's on Zoom are you in Georgia today or Vegas?
I think he's in Vegas.
I'm at the Highlands in North Carolina, actually,
Carol. Oh, so neither.
You know, you travel more than we do. I don't know. We just talked about the airlines, like, domestically having some issues. You are flying around.
I support the airlines.
I know. Well, having said that, would you be a buyer of airlines after that JetBlue news? It's really tanking in today's session.
You know, with oil prices high, I think that that's an area that I would probably be cautious with right now. But overall, you know, earnings so far has been really good across the board. I mean, of the companies that reported last week, I think 160, over 80% beat earnings with an average of 9.2%. That's actually from Bloomberg. We had a research committee this morning call, and we were doing some research with Bloomberg, and that's from you guys. And then, you know, including this week, we have twice as many upgrades as downgrades. So companies are navigating this high interest rate environment. And of course, we saw the GDP number in third quarter was phenomenal. And the consumers are still spending, surprising everybody.
All right, full disclosure, because that's how we are at Bloomberg. That's how we roll. What do you mean you were doing some work and research with Bloomberg?
Well, we have a Bloomberg terminal as well. And our investment committee, our CIO, does a lot of work on the terminal with research and so forth. So that was one of the statistics that we were looking at, was just the earnings updates for companies last week and this week so far.
Okay, just we like transparency, No, but earnings make sense, Jess. We're in the midst of it. We're on the other side of it, right, in terms of the bulk of numbers.
If you're not buying JetBlue, what stocks are you buying?
Well, let's talk about fixed income still. So we think that we're at the top of the cycle on rates. And while rates have been very volatile for the last 30, 60 days, we think that leaning into duration, I know a lot of other investors have done that, but leaning into duration now, I think, is a good, safe bet for the next few years. Maybe not short-term trade, but for the next few years.
How far out would you go? How far out on the curve would you go?
Well, believe it or not, we actually added some zeros so that we could add just a teeny bit to get a lot more, potential benefit from it. So. But I think adding duration past, you know, even 7 years might make sense for a lot of investors. For your long-term money, I think it's one of the easiest trades to make long-term. Mm-hmm. On the equity side, I think that the interest-sensitive sectors that have been beaten up lately, real estate, tech stocks, I think that have an opportunity to take another run before the end of the year. And so I'm glad that there's still a lot of bearish people out there. But I think what could happen is that, you know, the Fed probably won't raise rates tomorrow, right? According to the futures market in December, probably not as well. A lot of investors think that they're done. And if that becomes a consensus that they're done, I think there could be a lot of money down the road here chasing equity soon.
You mentioned real estate, that sector in the S&P 500 up about 2% today, well outperforming the other industry groups. What is it particularly that you like about real estate?
Well, publicly traded real estate stocks have been, you know, discounted off of the whole value of real estate in general last year and continuing with this year. And so we think that there is value in publicly traded real estate. I think you should be very active with that investment and, you know, maybe not necessarily overweighted too much, but there are areas that have been really beat up with interest rates going higher. That's one of them. And so I think in historically speaking, when that's happened before, the public real estate market catches up and it could happen very quickly. So I think that investors can have an opportunity there. Like I said, also with technology stocks, but also, you know, I think quality is very important today.
Jimmy, hang on a second before you move on from real estate, you know, location, 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 also type, type, type. I mean, there's industrial, there's commercial, there's residential, there's logistics plays. There's a lot of ways to play it. So if there's long value in play in real estate, what is that long value play specifically?
I think you can be active in actually not just in public real estate. In public real estate, I would say that investors can go into general REITs. You know, I know everybody's scared about the office sector, but the office sector represents a smaller percentage of the general, you know, public REIT sector out there. But in private real estate, I think there are a lot of vehicles out there that a lot of investors can get money invested into, not just high net worth investors nowadays with products out there. With fresh capital, I think savvy real estate investors will have opportunity to buy and get into to take over projects at a discount relative to where they were a year ago. So I think you have to be very selective and work with people that are experts in that space. But also on the debt side, I know that we've been long in the tooth talking about private credit. And again, with fresh capital, I think with private credit, you can get opportunities now that we just haven't seen in a long time. Again, that's a private credit's a wide space in, you know, just talk about the different types of options to invest into with different managers, be very selective there again. And I would stick with trying to be a little bit more conservative with those loans as much as possible too.
I have a question about private credit. I'm glad you brought it up because that is a $1.5 trillion corner in the market right now. Recent weeks, we've seen money come out of stocks, also come out of money market funds. Is that money going to private credit?
I think a lot of it is. Jess, and I think that, you know, especially now that there are vehicles that retail investors can invest into without being locked up as long as they used to have to be for private credit investments. And so I think there are the, you know, proliferation of different types of investment vehicles out there nowadays and in the private credit space allows a lot of participants to, you know, be in that investment rather than just institutional before. And right. So I think some of that money is leaving money markets and equities too, because you can get double digit yields and with pretty good protection on the collateral.
Hey, Jimmy, 25 seconds, a new, you know, wealthy client comes to you and says, I got a bunch of money to invest. Where do you put it right now? Just quickly, really quickly.
It's a very interesting time right now, but I would just go back to if it's long-term money, 75% of the time, the stock market's higher 12 months later. So I would say that we probably wouldn't be putting it all to work day one, but certainly a good chunk of it should be invested in a beautifully diversified portfolio.
Got it.
And with a lot of quality companies that can do well, even if we get into a little bit of a slowdown here at some point.
All right. Well, be well. Happy Halloween. Jimmy Lee, of course, founder and CEO at the Registered Investment Advisor Wealth Consulting Group, joining us on this Tuesday.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of.
Oh,
look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein.
It's okay, Johan. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.